All right, boys, just listen up for a sec. Can you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
How does that sound make you feel? Give me some adjectives.
It's nice. It's kind of like reassuring. Steady.
That sounds like a very accurate kind of... I really like the sound of that mechanism.
It's very precise, isn't it?
Yeah. It also makes me feel like I should be somewhere that I'm not. Like I'm in a rush or something.
What have
I
forgotten?
Kind of running late. But it does sound very nice.
I think all of that is very valid, boys. But let me tell you, this is the sound of a British-designed mechanical timepiece from the talented team at Marlowe Watch Company, sponsors of this episode. And with Marlowe, each collection is influenced by a historical story of inspiring human endeavour. Now, I've spent some time at their HQ recently because, well, I'm curious about mechanical timekeeping and also how things work. And I can tell you that there is so much very pleasing attention to detail that goes into each and every watch design. Now, these guys are serious about their watches, and you can tell by looking at some of the watch reviews online. I mean, the words quality and value come up time and again. Visit marlowewatchcompany.com to see for yourself. Marlowe Watch Company, time well spent, which I also like to think could be said for this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, before we get going in earnest on this week's podcast, we've a special announcement to make. Jono, over to you.
Thank you, Robert. I just wanted to say that just recently I got my very first physical advanced copies of the new book of Sketchpedations called Big Ideas, Little Pictures.
Come on.
Explaining the world one sketch at a time. And I have to say, it's really nice. But I would say that, obviously. I have to say that. But it is genuinely
Can you
really
hold it
nice.
Up again for us, please?
Yeah, there we go.
Because we have seen some of the copies and obviously some of the photos. That is... Look at that.
So it's, what you can't see that I'm holding up is about 7 inches by seven. So it's square, but it's quite chunky.
Yeah.
It's got like a lot of body to it and a lovely cover illustration. And it's packed full of 130 plus sketches, many from the archives that you probably haven't seen, and a bunch of new ones in there, especially made for the book.
Now, I have seen it. And so as a totally impartial... member to this
best friend or
I can say it is excellent. It feels good, it feels weighty, it feels like pure quality just oozing out of this book. And when you flick through it, there's color and there's intrigue on every single page. So Jono, if people were interested to find out more about this or even to put in a pre-order, where would they go?
Yeah, it's dead easy. It's at sketchpenations.com/book. And I should say that it's out for pre-order. It's released in the US 9th of April and in the UK on 13th of May, and other countries and other areas. I'm trying as much as I can, working with the publisher, to get more distribution in all across the world. Australia's had a lot of calls for it and that, for example. So but sketchpenations.com/book, there's a few little videos, there's a little bit some photos of it there, so go check it out. Thank you. People say the devil is in the detail, but I think like the diamonds are in the details. Like actually,
ooh, nice.
Sometimes the details really matter.
I had a relationship where we went out canoeing, and I did get out on the sandbank in the middle of the estuary.
You had just, enough. Just couldn't take it.
It just wasn't going well.
A few deep breaths.
I literally got out and had to have a bit of a moment.
Same with like food and treats, you know. Nice little bit of chocolate every now and then. Ooh, that's nice.
Cheesecake. I really like cheesecake, but if I was
if having it every day,
yeah, pretty soon
you'd lose the taste of it.
More is more. Faster is fitter. Bigger is better. Don't be so naive. Hello and welcome to Sketchplanations, the podcast. How did you get here? What? How did you get here? What do you mean? Like, what transport did I take? Or what route? How did you get here? Ah, do you mean in life? How did I get to this point in life where I'm talking to you here and now? How did you get here? How did you get here? Listen, I'm done with this, mate. I don't know who you are or what you're trying to do, but you're an idiot. No matter how you got here, we're very pleased that you are. I'm Rob Bell. Came on the bus. And joining me on the podcast, energized from their tenacious tandem ride here, uphill and down dale, at the helm and in charge of navigation, it's John O'Hay. And sneakily watching YouTube clips of 1980s movie blunders on his phone at the rear, it's Tom Pellerow. Good evening, my friends. How are you both?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Yeah.
Tandems. Tommy, have you still got your tandem? I remember you had one years ago.
Absolutely.
I mean, you got it. Did you buy that for the specific reason I'm thinking of?
So Sarah got it, borrowed it from a friend for our first, second ever date. And then later she actually managed to buy it from the guy because he was moving away. And then we did it up and we actually rode away from our wedding on it, on our wedding day.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, it was incredible.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant.
And it's great photos.
Yeah, so didn't it have just married on the back?
Yeah, a little big sign on the back. And there was a bit of controversy, which I didn't really realise until later, that the night before, Sarah's mum, my wife's mum, had said, you definitely can't leave the wedding on that. And Sarah was adamant that we were. I didn't know about this at all. So they almost had a massive falling out the night before the wedding. And Sarah had to do loads of sort of maintenance on the bike to ensure that no oil went on her wedding dress on the day, which was obviously what Sarah's mum was most concerned about.
Have you still got it?
Yeah.
You still got the bike? Yeah.
And I've got to say, it is a really good new relationship tester. When we've got friends coming over and they're sort of newly together or they've only been together about a year, because it's quite difficult to ride. It requires quite a lot of coordination and the brakes are not kind of great, so you've got to do it together and you've got to be in time, and the sort of mini little arguments or sometimes really quite big arguments are really quite enjoyable to watch.
Canoes are similar, aren't they? Where you're like, no. You want to paddle right, paddle right. Mm. No, the other way. I am doing it. No, but you're steering, but no, you're going the wrong way. Yeah. Stressful.
Johnny, you're absolutely right, because I had a relationship where we went out canoeing and I did get out on the sandbank in the middle of the estuary. It was just
you had enough. Couldn't take it.
It just wasn't going well.
Really?
I literally got out and had to have a bit of a moment because, like, this is oof.
Oh, that is excellent. That is very good.
Long time ago, but you are right. Very good tests.
Of course, we've all experienced a tandem, right? Or a six-man bike.
Yes.
For the charity thing we did a few years ago,
that was, we rode a six-man bike.
It was, from London to Amsterdam, six saddles all in a line. It was about, I don't know, 5-6 meter long bike. So massive thing.
Nearly impossible to steer.
Yeah.
Only Tom could do it.
Mini roundabouts were an absolute nightmare. Yeah.
And especially dangerous for the person at the back.
Yeah. You just get straight through him.
Who, I think a couple of times, the person at the back got clipped off by some kind of sign or post or something like that.
Yeah. It's probably why they don't sell them commercially.
And the fact that, where would you store it?
Anyway, yeah.
I was reminded, though, as you said that, about a sketch I have in tandem, because it was around that time when we did it that I'd learned that in tandem isn't anything to do with like two people. I guess I always thought it was like two people.
I did, yeah. Guess is it not?
That's always what you see. No, it actually means one in front of another. So you could have a carriage pulled by two horses side by side as a pair, or you could have the horses in tandem and one in front of another, or you could have six people on a bike in tandem, one in front of another.
Yeah. Oh, okay, nice. Okay. Then something new every day.
It's an old one, but still going.
Yeah, good. Well, look, whatever journey you've been on to have ended up listening to this podcast will possibly be a story of adventure in itself. A long stream of lifestyle decisions, turns in the road, and let's not forget your friend of mine, Google Algorithms. And now that you are here, let's do it. Let's podcast. And I have to say that the boys did really well there, because we had to do all of that chat again because I forgot to record the first one. And it was organic and it was natural, and we took it in different directions. Boys, well done. Apologies for my mistakes.
Professionals.
Let's podcast. This week, we're tackling Jono's very fun sketch, actually, on the law of diminishing returns. Now, you should be able to see that sketch in front of you now on your device, but there's a link in the podcast description as well, just in case your podcast player has other ideas. You can find the whole of the back catalogue of Jono's sketches at sketchplanations.com. And if you'd like to send us a note about the podcast or anything we talk about within it now, or in fact, any of the previous episodes, you can wing your emails over to
hello@sketchplanations.com.
You'd have thought the second time round it'd have been on that a bit quicker.
Well, I don't quite know when you're going to say it. I was quicker that time, but it's true.
We'll be going through your messages from last week at the end of the podcast. Thank you, Tommy. Jono, I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway because it brings me a lot of joy to think about it again. Please, can you describe your sketch on the law of diminishing returns and tell us where your idea for the sketch came from?
So the law of diminishing returns is, I know it from production processes, which is typically that at some point, doing more of one thing stops giving you the same amount of benefit it did when you started adding more of it. And so I was trying to give a more concrete example that people would get, and so the sketch is just a chart of broth quality and number of cooks, is something hopefully everybody can relate to, with the old phrase, too many cooks spoil the broth. And so on the one hand, you've got this sole chef cook, I should say, standing next to a giant vat of broth. Yes. And the quality is low, and then as you add cooks, the broth quality increases until way over on the right hand side you've got like 12 cooks, and you know, half of them are just having a tea break and the other half are getting in each other's way, and the broth quality has decreased again. So the idea is that as you start adding cooks, it helps, but it gradually starts to help less and less until you can often get to a point where as you add more of something, it actually gets worse. And I think there are a lot of examples of that. I should say that I linked to it in the text underneath, but it comes from, the idea comes from a sketch series, BBC sketch series, a long time. It was a bit of a love it or hate it kind of series.
Big Train is the name of the series, if you want to look it up.
But one of them was, it's just brilliant every time I see it. Which is somebody who's working in the broth department of a factory, and they're having a big seminar and somebody's up at the front and he's got a big whiteboard with a diagram a bit like this with all these chefs crowded around some broth, and he's explaining to everybody, the vat of broth has too many broth makers, or cooks, if you will. And it's this surfeit of cooks that's having such a negative impact on the broth. There's too many cooking staff and it's ruining the product. You'd think, wouldn't you, that adding more cooks would make it better. But no.
It's making it worse.
It's actually Simon Pegg in one of his really early roles. And he's sitting there.
It's full of comedy acting genius.
There's a few on YouTube of mixed quality, but some are hilarious, and this one is excellent. Yeah,
the main protagonist of the sketch has previously been at the cake factory, right? And he's been moved to the broth division because of his smart aleck quips. and in the cake division, there was it was a positive feedback sales report, wasn't it, on how their slightly warmed up cakes were selling really well.
Been bought at a tremendous rate, selling like nobody's business, selling like they're going out of fashion because we've warmed them up first.
Well, you could say
selling like hotcakes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll put a link in the podcast description to that sketch. It's well worth a watch, as are many other Big Train sketches. Absolutely,
it's probably funnier when Simon Pegg does it.
Yeah, well, you know, but yeah, it's hard to explain sketches, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the genesis of the sketch, really.
Yeah, and it works really well, right? Because it makes the point, because everybody knows the expression "too many cooks spoil the broth," right?
Exactly.
But so it was in production and production manufacturing, that kind of thing, that you first were thinking of, is it?
Yeah, and I see it in my job and the design of products all the time. You know, like if you're doing uptime for software, for example, like if you don't want your site to go down, you can work on eliminating every last second of downtime and every last problem and every last bug. But the effort to go those last few cases is sometimes huge. And there's a really nice classic example, and I do have a sketch of this actually, which is that if you do five user tests, you typically find 85% of problems.
Oh, okay.
So if you make a new design, do some tests, you'll keep finding problems if you keep showing it to more people. But actually, if you do five, you'll find 85% of the problems.
Yeah.
So go fix those and then go do it again if you want to.
Yeah.
And so as you add more, you get that law of diminishing returns kicking in. And I think you always have those decisions of like, how much is good enough and is it worth us going that extra mile? Like if you're trying to machine something to a certain precision or tolerance, if you want to go that extra little bit, it might cost you a fortune to go to that extra little bit.
So how much
is it worth it?
In return, will you be getting from having a product of that much higher quality that's cost that much to produce? Is that going to come back to you in sales or in revenue?
I think about this a lot with stereos, like a stereo in a car. So like obviously like listening to music on your phone is a bit unsatisfying, right? It's quite tinny. And so it's much better to have a better speaker and it's much better to have a really good speaker. And at some point you're like, this speaker costs twice as much as this other mega speaker and I can't really hear the difference anymore. And it might be better, but yeah, for the cost and the effort that you're putting in, you can't hear the difference so well. So I think it comes up in, how people appreciate and perceive products and the benefit you're putting in. So some people, that might be exactly what worth it. Most people, probably not.
Yeah. Tommy, how do you feel about the law of diminishing returns? Is it something you're conscious of as somebody who's in manufacturing and making products and running a business?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Different facets of it,
as you say, as an inventor and someone who runs a small business, I find it's just one big battle against this sort of law of diminishing returns. You know, in my own personal behavior, in my engineers' behavior, in my graphics team, you know, we are trying to bring products to market of the kind of the latest professional grade beauty innovations at the best possible prices. And you just constantly have to be drawing that line on that perfectionism. Tomorrow we launch 10 new products at an event in central London, and every single one of those was just a constant, you know, okay, how much more time do we research on red lights, or how many more red lights do we need to put on? How much larger should the battery be to kind of have this? Well, are people going to be bothered between the difference of being able to use this product 10 times or 15 times before having to recharge it? You know, we could have made it that someone could use it and never have to recharge it again, but then it would be much bigger, much more expensive, and that people expect to have to recharge things. And as John has just said, we had an example today of a label for a new bottle of gel polish remover, which had probably been looked at by 10 people. And one person replied saying, "Ooh, do you think in the instructions we should add, you know, buff the nail first?" And I was like, "Oh gosh, please, not another." But I was like, "No, well, hang on. Actually, you're absolutely right. We do need to add those two words. Those are really important." So that was an example where an extra cook had helped improve the broth. Although the graphics lady who then had to change it was like, "Are you kidding me, Tom?" I'm like, "I agree. We've been through this a lot. But this change is worth making because it's a really important little detail." I did get her to make that change.
It must be very hard with something that is undefined, like bringing a product to market and inventing and designing that product in the first place.
Yes.
It must be very hard to know when to stop. When is good enough? Because it's, you know, I think some people suffer from the kind of this desire for perfectionism the whole time, but you know, at some point, you know, what is perfect? You know, try and embrace the ethos that, you know, not everything that you do has to be perfect. You know, it can be good enough.
And maybe so, I very vividly remember a teacher telling me when I was 11, he was a sort of extra English teacher, he was like, "Tom, you're a perfectionist and a dyslexic. They're just, you can't be both, and you will always be dyslexic. So you're just going to have to try and work out your level of perfectionism." And actually, at age 11, that was a really important and really helpful lesson to learn.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And as you say, you know, I employ these brilliant engineers and they will carry on researching into something forever. But as a result, I also have to employ some amazing sort of business people to help me kind of, as you say, draw that line of when do we stop going into this and when do we make sure we've got the right brilliant level of product, but something that we could actually launch because we could spend another 5 years researching this.
What we're talking about here, is this a little bit 80-20 rule? You know, that 80% of the success or the positive output from our actions and energies results from 20% of the input.
Yeah.
20% of the time or energy that you put in is what's going to yield 80% of the result.
Definitely, but it's a very good hindsight rule, I find. You don't often, if you knew what the 80-20 was when you were doing it, you wouldn't do the 20.
If you knew where that threshold was.
But you often don't know it until after the fact, which is pretty tricky. I must say, I think Lord Sugar, he's very good in this respect. He is very good at identifying the areas that are really important to look at and where you can simplify things. And there was a lovely example that's in his book when he first launched the Sky boxes. So I don't know if you know, like, the reason Sky was able to launch is basically Amstrad made those first few boxes and the dishes that went inside of the houses. And there's a lovely story in his book where he's quite rude about techie people. So he was like, these boffins had told me that the shape of this metal had to be this and that and blah, blah, blah. And it was going to cost £80 for this perfect shape. And I was like, it's just a dish, right? So I found this bin lid maker in Birmingham who charged me literally £1 for something that these boffins were telling me was, you know, there's high science, but it was going to cost £80. And we put it on, and lo and behold, it worked perfectly.
Fired all the boffins.
And so he was like, well, so therefore Amstrad were able to bring out, you know, those boxes at like £69, I think they launched at, instead of like hundreds of quid, you know.
But you know, if you look at your graph, Jono, on the sketch, it's all about trying to, I guess, predict and analyze as best you can when you're at that point of optimization.
I think it's not just where it might start getting worse. And there are definitely cases where, you know, you keep adding people to a team.
Yes.
And it does speed you up to a point. And then after that, it probably just gets in the way.
Communication and becomes difficult. Yeah. And
you have to manage it and it actually might get worse. But there are, but it's also, I think, you're constantly having to try and make a trade-off. Like we can make it better, but it will be a bit better. Like I can fix another bug.
Yeah.
But instead of fixing that bug, we could live with the odd problem and we'll build something else, which will have more benefit. And you always have to make those trade-offs because you're not getting like fixing a bug that stops somebody, like your website turning on, you know, just crashes everything. Of course, that's worth doing. So you get loads of value for fixing that.
Yeah.
But fixing something which affects, you know, 2% of people who use this browser once a week, you're like, well, okay, well, maybe we should do that. Maybe we shouldn't. And that's where you're still getting some benefit by doing it. But so there's a point where it gets worse very often, but there's also points where you're like, well, should we? I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's just, it's always difficult
to
try and make those trades because there's no, it's like it's all a bit of a grey area, you know.
We've talked a lot about work so far, kind of work applications to this, but there are loads of different applications where I think it applies in maybe your family life, in your home life, in your kind of social life. I mean, I'm thinking back to when we were all revising for exams at university and I stayed up. I did some all-nighter revision sessions because I, you know, left it all too late and obviously didn't know enough at the time. So you're cramming and you're cramming and you're cramming, which meant that you got into that exam and you're absolutely knackered. Surely it would have been better to have said, right, enough's enough. I'm going to get at least 4 hours sleep and go in a little bit fresh.
At least 4 hours.
Crazy. Well, that's how Robbie rolled.
And I think it's the same with sport as well. If you're training for a race or something, you know, if you're cramming in your training in the last 2 weeks, actually, you're probably better off giving your body a really good rest so that you're going into the race fresh. I've definitely struggled with that before as well.
Yeah, I can relate to both of those. Like the studying for exams, like you can do every single past paper ever, and it might add one or two marks, yeah. but it might take you another 2 days of studying. So, like, is that worth it? Mm. And I think with health as well, like, yeah, doing a little bit of exercise is a lot better than doing no exercise. Yes. And doing moderate exercise on a regular basis is really good. But doing tons of exercise every day,
knacker your joints.
You know, maybe it's good, but certainly not nearly as good as like getting off the sofa in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of your benefit, unless you're training for ultras or something, you don't need to do that much.
Yeah. And then there's things like friendships, right? So how many friends? We talked a little bit about this in the episode on Dunbar's Law at the beginning of the series. But, you know, the more and more and more friends you have, how well do you really know any of them? Or
I think about like how often you see people as well. So like, it's obviously not brilliant to see people once every 2 years. So once a year is better. Once every 6 months, probably better. Once every 3 months. But when you get down to like, I don't know, should I see somebody every day? You're probably getting, you're getting diminishing returns. That, so maybe you could actually be better off if you saw each other a bit less.
Gosh, tricky, isn't it? It's tricky, all this stuff.
What's the optimum amount to see people? I don't know.
Boozing. There's a law of diminishing returns. I mean, first couple of pints. Oh, lovely. I'm really on the up here. I'm having a great time. Four. I mean, who am I talking about here? Not me anymore. Not me anymore, that's for sure.
Four alcohol-free beverages, maybe, Robert.
Right, but then when you've really started hitting gone from the beers to the wine and the spirits, I mean, then it's all downhill from there, isn't it?
They're just a sliding down that chart.
And the tandem that you were talking about earlier, you know, how I was sitting on the back, potentially watching videos. I think we all found that there was a certain maximum speed that you could go to. There really wasn't any point trying to put any more effort in, because the massiveness of it didn't go any faster.
That's how you justified it, Tommy. You use science to try and bamboozle everybody on the bike.
Everybody else is working really hard because Tommy's not pedaling.
But I was looking into this a little bit, and historically, apparently, one of the earliest mentions of the law of diminishing returns was recorded in the mid 1700s. An economist called Jacques Turgot, and he was articulating what would become the law of diminishing returns in agriculture. And again, most of the early references that I've found were all about agriculture. So, you know, with the same amount of land, you're employing more and more people to come and work on it. And at a point,
doesn't make any difference.
Those returns drop.
Yeah.
Drop off.
The same about like fertilization, like if adding fertilizer, like obviously adding a bit really helps, and adding a good amount really, really helps. But then beyond some point, it starts to like, actually just wash off and doesn't get taken up by the plants at all, you know, that kind of thing. So I think you get that with fertilization as well.
Yeah. What about holidays? So how many holidays do you have a year, roughly? Two main holidays?
It depends what you call a holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what if every day was a holiday? You wouldn't get the benefit anymore, would you? Same with like food and treats, you know, a nice little bit of chocolate every now and then. Ooh, that's nice. Really? What if you started having loads
cheesecake.
Of...
Cheesecake. I really like cheesecake, but...
If you had it every day...
If I was having it every day...
You'd lose the taste of it.
Pretty soon.
Jono, I recently came up with one in the shower that I thought you might quite like, because it's environmental as well, in the fact that I've started when I have the shower, rather than... Because I used to always get in the shower and put it on full power, and you'd sit there in full power. And I was like, actually, you know, with gas prices, global warming... So I started just having my shower to about half. And I was finding it wasn't... There was a lot less water coming out... But actually, I found I could get all the way down to at least half the power, and sometimes a bit less, and almost not really notice the difference. Like,
Right, Tommy, this makes perfect sense, right? If you go full power in a shower, I deem myself a bit of a shower expert.
I love
showers.
You are.
If you go full power in a shower, most of it just bounces off you, right? And it hits you at such a force that it bounces off and sprays the walls. And so it's the walls who are getting most of the heat and the energy and the soothing of the hot water. So come in halfway, and then it not a dribble, you know, a nice, you can feel there's some force behind it, but it's not going to spray off everywhere, and it's actually going to stick to you and run down. Yeah, that's nice. That's where you
maybe a little bit of power at the beginning, a little bit at the end, just to, you know, but treat yourself with the full power at some points. But
yeah.
Shower we're not animals. Doing, missing out on all these potential improvements.
But the natural instinct is you get in a shower and you just flick it to what you think is on, the sort of binary off or on. But actually, there's that whole spectrum in between.
I see the spectrum, and I like to enjoy variety within the spectrum.
On that note, I'm going to turn the brightness of my screen down a bit as well. Does it make that much difference being that bright?
Does it? Diminishing returns.
Yeah, it's almost dazzling.
It's being blinding.
Turn it down a bit.
Tom's going to go around the house turning everything down. Dimmers. Just turn it. Law of diminishing returns, Sarah. Yeah. I'm turning the lights down.
I did think about that, actually. I was trying to think about when diminishing returns might be a problem, and I was thinking about tidying and when you might have differences in perception as to how tidy is tidy enough.
Yes.
So you might stop and go, well, I could tidy that last bit, but this is fine. And somebody else might go, this is still not fine, and if we tidy that, it would be much better. And you think it would just be a little bit better. And that might lead to arguments.
This is interesting. Did I ever? Yes. So it's a.
Yeah. I've got.
Sorry, it's a difference in interpretation of where that peak point is.
Yes. And so when Sarah and I 10 years ago decided to move in together, my first rule is that we must get a cleaner, because I knew that my level of it's clean enough would be very different to her level of what clean is, and so therefore I'd always end up getting in trouble, you know, for the shower, for example. I think I would probably
I wasn't going to ask which way that went. I thought you were going to leave that ambiguous.
No, it's good to learn each other's levels on these things. I found,
can I give you guys another little factet? So apparently Henry Ford of Ford Motor Vehicles ran a lot of productivity experiments to determine how to get the highest value out of his production lines and his employees. And in an interview in 1926, Henry Ford concluded that 40 hours a week was the optimum number of hours for his employees on the production lines, finding that, you know, when people work more than 40 hours, their output per employee.
How much work have you done today?
loads. Their output starts to decline.
I was reminded when we were talking about that sort of study, there was around, there's this chap called Taylor, and Taylorism was like the optimization of production lines down to like timing everybody's individual steps. How long does it take you to move this part from here to here? And then he would go around and treat people like cogs in a machine, literally.
I've
seen some studies about temperature and productivity in offices. And interestingly, I remember it said basically like the lower the temperature in the office, the more the productivity goes up. And I just remember that in the study, they didn't find it leveling off. It's just that you kept lowering the temperature in the office, and it kept on going up. Obviously, they didn't, you know, start testing at 0 degrees or anything like that. But you would imagine it was probably going to level off at some point.
At some point.
Definitely levels off.
Do you think it helps us live a happier life if we're conscious of the law of diminishing returns in stuff that we do? And try and figure ways to game it.
Definitely.
To kind of know the optimum.
Definitely. I think life is a big experiment to try and find the kind of optimums of certain different things. The optimums of when to speak and when not to, for example.
Being happy with what you've got is a good recipe. There are studies on how money affects happiness, and I think that's like a real case of diminishing returns.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. That's
really good.
So you can imagine if your income is really low, let's say an extra $10,000 a year makes a huge difference in getting your, you know, basic necessities of life covered, right?
Yep.
You know, having a house, a place to live, and being able to buy the food and stuff. As you go up, you can imagine that going from, you know, say 30K to 30 to 50, Okay, probably also makes a difference, but then it starts to sort of slow down this effect. And it's not to say that this is, to my understanding, definitely like wealthier people are happier. But if you add an extra £10,000 to a low level of income, it makes a big difference in your happiness. If you add an extra 10,000, you're already earning 120, then it doesn't make much of a difference. Yeah. And so it's sort of, you get diminishing returns there as well, I think, as it levels off. But, you know, people might think, oh, well, I need to win the lottery and I need to have this, you know, not just this house, but a bigger house, a much bigger house. And will it actually make you happier? Probably not.
Mm.
Or not very much happier.
So where do you think it doesn't hold true? Where do you think there are any aspects of life or areas where this law doesn't kick in, diminishing returns?
It's a good
I mean, I was thinking question. along the lines like perfecting a skill, if you want to be a really highly skilled musician or woodworker or something.
Olympic athlete.
Is there enough time in one's life to have truly perfected it?
Yeah, an Olympic athlete.
Yeah.
To be the very, very best at something.
You have to go all in, absolutely everything, minutiae details in your training regime and everything that you prepare with.
I was thinking it's possible to make a business where the raison d'etre or the mission of your business is you're selling a story about being the very best.
Yeah.
And you can charge disproportionately large amounts for
that.
And to some degree, I think like Apple do that kind of stuff, right? Like you can buy a laptop for £600, but if you want to buy an Apple one, they're going to charge you £2,500 or something.
Yeah.
And it's better. How much better? Well, you have that perception that it's really AirPods. I struggle with AirPods. You know, they're a bit better. Probably than a lot of other wireless earbuds.
Yeah.
But they can charge twice as much for them. And I think you perhaps market on the basis that we are that much better and you need this and it makes you want it. So maybe there's something there as well.
Like
luxury goods.
Perhaps. Luxury goods like wine and whiskey and those sort of things you feel are very much in that similar field, Johnny.
There is no top limit. Everything just keeps getting pushed.
Potentially, and that's sort of what you're selling, and that's your MO. Yeah.
That's the old Veblen goods.
Yeah.
Again, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I do often wonder about parenting and, that. And yes, there is diminishing returns in terms of how much time and how much quality of time. But someone did very wisely say to me once, you know, kids actually just want you around as much as possible. Like they just really love being close to you, being with you at the earlier ages, certainly. And so I do try and do that as much as I possibly can. There must be a diminishing returns, but I think kids would happily have you around more and more and more, certainly at the younger ages.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, wait till they turn to teenagers. Yeah, that's possibly where you see the diminishing return.
People say the devil is in the detail, but I think like the diamonds are in the details. Like actually, sometimes the details really matter. Mm. And there's a sketch, which I really like, which is this poem, For Want of a Nail. And I don't know if you know it, but I'll read it out because it's just so obvious once you hear it. And so the poem goes, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the kingdom was lost. And all for want of a nail. And that starts to mess with your head, doesn't it? When you're doing diminishing returns and then somebody comes up with something right at the end. And you're like, that could be the nail that fixes the shoe, which helps the horse, which keeps the rider, which wins the battle, which keeps the kingdom.
Yeah. Wow. So on that example, for the last 6 weeks, I've been experimenting with different magnet strengths because the magnet has not been holding on this Zoom mirror correctly on a product. And we've literally spent 6 weeks researching into magnet strengths and configuration of, because we know that if you put something on, you want it to stay. You don't want it slipping. But oh my gosh. But we know we've got to get it right. It's hugely diminishing returns, but it has to be perfect in this example.
Or is it like a step? Like it's not good enough, and then it's good enough. And you don't have like a gradual thing in that case. Anyway, as I'm wondering about like, yeah, should I do that final edit or something? I also have it in the back of my mind, for want of a nail. Oh, no.
And it's very hard to know. It's impossible to know without hindsight which is the right thing to do. Do you go 80-20 law of diminishing, or do you go, no, it's actually worth it this time?
Yeah. For that matter, you got the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
And you got tipping points.
Yeah.
If you get just that one more follower or one more person to buy it, maybe it will tip it over.
Something
to start rolling by itself. Ugh, chicken and egg things, you know. Yeah, difficult.
Ugh. Good luck, everyone.
So I think there's also a big example in our podcast recording. We tend to sit here talking for between 35 and an hour and 35 sometimes. And then Rob, you amazingly edit it down to a 30 minute. And I slightly always wonder, what did he cut out and what did he miss? But I think we could carry on talking for another 3 days and probably come up with some more examples, but you wouldn't let it be longer than half an hour, because our listeners probably don't want to listen to half an hour. They've had enough and just the perfect amount.
What a great way to round us off, Tommy. Thank you very much. AOB, any other business on the law of diminishing returns?
Oh, I do have one that might make it through the edit, which would be ironic in the fact that, so I always get invited to the live filming of the final episode of The Apprentice, and they sort of twig me before saying, you know, and at the end we might come to you and ask you a quick question. So I'm there sort of for 4 hours watching this, thinking that they might ask me a little question at the end, which, given I'm not on telly that much anymore, kind of is quite a big deal, and possibly I'm trying to get illegally a plug about my brand onto the BBC, and I sit there, but I know that if I talk for more than about 10 seconds they'll just cut it, because they don't have more than that much time for me in the thing. But also you want to say a lot, and whenever I speak too long it gets cut. If I create a nice little quick short segment it might get through, but that's a lovely example.
Thank you very much, boys. The law of diminishing returns. And as with so many topics that we chat about on this podcast, it's one of those things in life that's just everywhere, right? You know, it's all around us all the time. Sometimes we're probably conscious of it, and other times less so. But it's definitely a thing. Of course it is. John has done a sketch on it. It must be.
It must be.
If you have some examples in your lives where you've discovered that the law of diminishing returns has crept in, then let us know. Email us on hello@sketchplanations.com. Now, we'll be back with this week's postbag very shortly. But for now, Tommy, I am going to close out before the law comes after us with its truncheon and its handcuffs in hand. It weren't us, Gov. You'll never catch us. We're not going down. Go well. Stay well. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See ya.
Hello, welcome back. We've got time to go through just a few messages from last week's postbag. As a reminder, last week we were talking about Smart Little People, the fun design tool as part of Triz. So on Twitter, we've had a message from Captain Karnak saying that colleagues that he works with scoffed when he raised Triz over 10 years ago at a robotics company. He says, however, I am a fan. Do you see how it could have been a difficult thing to introduce in companies where you've worked at that kind of company level, to bring in a whole new way of thinking and a philosophy?
I mean, when you put it like that, yeah. Yeah. I think there's also, we did a whole course in it and had people who are experts who taught us for years, which was brilliant. But there's a lot of mixed stuff about it. There's a bit of confusion about it. It's also, it doesn't have like a, you know, traditional roots for the story of like where it came from. So it's, you know, it doesn't come out of, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and wherever, you know, leading university. And so, yeah, there's definitely some skepticism around using it, but also a lot of sort of misinformation and people who don't really know much about it. And you know, so, yeah, that's natural, I think.
This one made me laugh, John. I hope you don't mind me reading it out. It's a Twitter message from a response on Twitter from Bobby Wildcard about the sketch of Smart Little People, which you should check out if you haven't seen it yet. It says, sorry, but I don't get how the Smart Little People in the sketch are stopping a leak. In fact, I don't even get how it's a leak. It looks like they're forming a human bridge over some stakes. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's got a point, you know. He did that one quite quick. Yeah, sorry about that.
Do you, Johnny, do you have a rule where you won't redo a sketch? Because you must look at some of your early sketches and go, oh, I could
Not because someone's commented on Twitter.
Or because you must feel tempted to.
Yeah, and then and in fact for the book, I went back and we picked quite a few older ones, and I did redo them, partly for consistency, but partly also to make them better, and partly because if you're going to do a book with something, you might as well not just throw in something that you did in 20 minutes. You should do it properly. So I have redone some older ones, but it's a big project if I was to go back and redraw the whole lot. So
no kidding,
I'm not signing up for that in a hurry.
And then going back a couple of weeks, we've had a number of messages come in on the On the Road compilation episode, which I really enjoyed doing that one, guys. I really enjoyed recording it. I really enjoyed editing it. It was a lot of fun. But a friend of the podcast, Andre Brown, messaged on LinkedIn saying about the windscreen phenomena from that On the Road episode. And he suggests that lower drag cars equals more laminar flow equals less bug splatter.
Does it make any difference though to the number plate?
Well, yeah, so that would be a good example.
And some of the studies were just measuring purely the number plate, I think, weren't they, which has stayed largely the same size.
Yeah, and I think there was another study that I mentioned as well that talks about the fact that older cars were boxier. It was proved that didn't have the effect you think it might, that Andre's suggesting. But one study does not theory make. I don't know.
Causation.
Get Tommy's face. And on that bombshell, I'm going to round off by reminding everybody, all our listeners, that Jono has a book coming out. It's coming out in the US, Jono, in April, is that right?
Yeah, early April.
And in the UK?
In mid-May.
And anywhere else in the world, we will wait to hear.
Yeah, hopefully I will have news on that very soon.
But look out for it. Big ideas, little pictures.
Correct.
Coming out soon. Guys, thanks very much. Thank you again, listeners, for all of your comments and feedback and stories. Keep them coming in. hello@sketchplanations.com on the email, or you can leave us comments or DMs on social media. Thanks very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
All music on this podcast series is sourced from the very talented Frank Cinelli. And you can find loads more tracks at frankcinelli.com.